We'd just taken August off again. And when people came back after, it's so clear that they'd had this really important time to decompress, to be themselves, to not have to wear a work hat. It felt like we were renewed.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, and today we're beginning another mini-series concentrating on the changing nature of work. We start by examining what work means to us. Does it define us in a healthy way, or are we addicted to it? For many Americans, jobs have become akin to a religion. They provide a paycheck, but also meaning, community, and a sense of purpose. The question is, are we expecting too much of our jobs to fulfill all these needs, and at what cost? Well, to help us truly grasp some of the complex issues bound up in this equation, we've got two speakers today who are both work experts. Simo Stolzhoff used to be a design lead for IDEO, a global innovation company based in Palo Alto in California. He left, took stock, and wrote the book The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work, in which he examines how work has come to dominate our lives and why we find it difficult to separate identity and self-worth from our jobs. Joe Hunter is the CEO of 64 Million Artists, and she co-founded this in 2014. She says she spent the first 30-odd years of her life being, quote, a massive perfectionist, anxious and terrified of failing. She finally took a month off, did a series of different creative challenges every day, and learned, quote, to enjoy the process of being creative without thinking of the outcomes. She said it changed her life. So welcome to both of you. Joe is joining us from UK and Simo is in Barcelona.
Lovely to be here.
Thanks for having us, Mary.
Speaking now about the vast majority of people, Joe, because you actually, your job is going into a lot of workplaces to help people be more creative in what they do. And I imagine some of them have very boring jobs or monotonous jobs. How does it help people when they're not looking for everything from their job by taking creativity into the workplace?
I think it's been really, you know, helpful and fascinating to me to kind of work with such a broad range of people. And like you said, some people who, for whom it really feels like their work is their life and their life is their work. And for some people, absolutely not at all. And I think the benefits are quite similar in depending on, you know, it doesn't really matter about your attitude. A lot of the things that we find are about kind of connection with yourself and connection with each other. So if you are spending your day with lots of people. So we, you know, we did a really great project in a factory in Folkestone in the UK, where we worked with people on the factory floor, people in the warehouse, people in the offices, and we gave them, so they work a 12-hour shift, they get a half an hour lunch break and 2 15-minute breaks, and they were allowed to take an extra 20-minute break a week for 10 weeks, so not that much more. And we worked with a sort of small team of them to devise these different creative challenges that they would like to do in that time. So they kind of would do it in their little team, depending on where they were in the business. And what we saw was this real shift in a sense of knowing each other, like having a connection with each other, feeling like they weren't just a number at work, but that they kind of had some level of like meaning in their workplace. They had a suggestions box in their workplace that never ever had any suggestions in, but suddenly it was full of suggestions. And they put up, you know, the stuff that they've been doing, they've been like putting up in the canteen, and then they were like, oh yeah, we could make this canteen really nice and we could do this, and they were sharing meals together. So that sense of your work doesn't have to be your be-all and end-all. It doesn't have to be your purpose, but you spend a lot of time there. So it's nice to feel like you're connected to it. It's certainly nice to feel like you can kind of show up as yourself and not feel like you're having to kind of put on a pretense, or you're not having to, yeah, behave differently. You know, one of the managers was saying, they did this thing where they had all these 20 questions, they guessed stuff about each other. And he was like, oh, I realized how little I knew about these people that I spend days, you know, every day with, and I have spent every day with for years. So that idea that it's kind of, yeah, bringing connection to life. Also, I think it, we see it as a result of that, but also as a result of having a new challenge, like whether in your work or having more time to do it outside of your work, people kind of feeling a sense of motivation or feeling uplifted, having a greater well-being because they're having a moment of thinking, oh, I didn't think I could do that thing, or I haven't done that thing for 20 years and I can do this. So actually, if I could do that, maybe I could do this, you know, that this kind of sense of sort of drive or intellectual stimulation. Yeah, impossibility. Yeah. So yeah, it's a really, it's a lovely thing that it feels both kind of internal and as a sort of connection with the people around you. They're the kind of main things that we see.
You wrote this very good piece, opinion piece for The Guardian, where you talked about why you had a 4-day work week for your company and why everybody took the entire month of August off. So your entire workforce have just come back from having a month off. And you said that you felt that in a climate where people are suffering from increased mental illness, absenteeism, and all sorts of other maladies, sick days, that this really wasn't a big deal, that it made really solid sense and it's worked for your company. So tell me a bit about, that was an experiment you did, was it last year for the first time?
Yeah, so we did it last year. You know, we were certainly noticing that, you know, everyone we were working with whether that was people in offices, people in schools, people in social care and health, everyone felt really burnt out and we were having to hold space for them. And everyone, we all felt like, you know, we'd just come through the pandemic and sort of wobbling out the other side. And everyone was exhausted. And it was actually, we read an article by Brené Brown, who said that she was actually herself taking 3 months off, but giving all of her staff an extra 4 weeks off over the summer, and essentially kind of shutting down what they were doing as a kind of recognition of, you know, we've all just been through this massive global event and no one seems to have done anything differently or noticed, or, you know, things changed massively and now we're all trying to just get back to normal. As soon as I read that, it was like, that's a really good idea. Let's do that. And that was in May. It was sort of a rush to get it done. But when people came back after, it's so clear that they'd had this really important time to decompress, to be themselves, to not have to wear a work hat, to kind of, and people did very different things. I was actually having a really tough time. There's loads of stuff going on at home that was really stressful. And it's not like I laid by a pool and relaxed, but what I didn't have to do was be another person. I just could be mum and me, like wife. That were the main things that I had to do in that time. And it's so essential for me to not completely burn out. And so when we came back and we were ready to like start work, it felt like we were renewed. We had a really exciting sense of what we wanted to do. We'd also just had so all the things that felt like they were important by the summer, at the beginning of the summer, when the time we got back, it was like, actually that thing is not worth doing. We can cut that. We can do this. We could be much bolder about how we thought about things. And we increased turnover by 50%. We've increased our staff by 50%. We've just taken August off again and we've put it in as a kind of standard work practice for the next however long. And we're pretty much, look, I think we'll do the same again. I think we'll be pretty much double the size again by this time next year. And it was like you were saying, Sima, the reason to do it isn't because of productivity. We're doing it because we genuinely believe it's really important for people. It's really important for us to take a break, to be ourselves, to have that time. And it does also make really good business sense for us because it really works.
Sima, you've obviously talked to very different people with a huge range of abilities and lifestyles in your book. The one that was most bizarre was the guy that decided that he would only do work that fulfilled him, work that paid a certain amount, like $140 an hour. What were the prerequisites he had? He had this kind of mandate for himself.
Yeah, it was. And then he would only work 20 hours a week at maximum. He called it the experiment. And you know, I think it points to an interesting trend. You know, historically, the wealthier an individual or the wealthier a country becomes, the fewer hours they work. This makes sense. It's because they can afford not to. But in the last 40 years or so, some of the greatest increases in work time have come from the highest earning Americans. As many people know, the reward for professional success is often more work on your plate. And so this guy, Josh, who I profile in one chapter in the book, was an advertising executive, a creative director that had sort of worked his way up the corporate ladder. And then he got to a certain point, and instead of trading his expertise for more money, which is customary, he decided to trade his expertise for more time and says, okay, I have these skills, I can leverage them in an effective way, but I also have a conception of what money I need to live. And therefore, I'm going to cap my hours, as opposed to just thinking that the only way to progress is going to go up and to the right. And, you know, it's very refreshing to hear Joe talk about taking the month of August off. You know, obviously I'm living in Europe at the moment and seeing the practice across the country of people taking August or a few weeks here, closing down the shop just for personal reason. It is a stake in the ground about the importance that we put on our lives outside of the office. You know, certainly there are elements of the business case that we see both in Joe's company and across many of these four-day workweek experiments around the world. The productivity often stays the same, if not increases, in the time. But I think what I am even more interested in is how people are choosing to spend that time that they now have, whether it's being a more present parent or investing in a local cause that you care about, or attending your community garden and fostering something in the local community. You know, the big kind of four-day workweek experiment that got a lot of press a few years ago was in Iceland. And there's one quote that still stands out to me from that study, which is the ability to have more time in the week made this one worker feel like their company was respecting their identities as a whole human, of seeing them as not just a worker or a producer of a higher share price, but also a parent and a good friend and a recreational footballer. And I think that is really the real benefit. Certainly, we know on an individual level that if you are burned out, if you are on hour 11 of a 12-hour day, or if you've worked 7 weeks in a row without taking a break, you're not going to be producing your best work. You're not going to be firing at all cylinders. I think, you know, executives will see what Jo saw in her company, that you will be able to attract better employees if you have more balance in your life. You'll be able to produce higher quality work. Your employees will churn at lower rates. But I think the real key here is to see how, when people have the time in their weeks to invest in other parts of who they are, it really has a ripple effect on people's lives, people's families, people's communities, and ultimately the world.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum's Reclaiming Life from Work with journalist Simo Stolzhoff, author of the book, The Good Enough Job, in which he examines how work has come to dominate our lives and why we find it difficult to separate identity and self-worth from our jobs. And Joe Hunter, CEO and co-founder of 64 Million Artists, discussing the nature of our relationship with work and how it shapes our identity. We've got a couple of questions that have come in. Miguel said, it is not only in what you work, but also in what city you may decide to work. In this sense, is Barcelona the good enough city to work?
I mean, I do think there is.
Miguel is from Barcelona, he says.
Well, maybe we'll meet up for some vermouth after. But I think there, you know, definitely is a cross-cultural component to this. And I think part of the impetus for the book for me is that my family is Italian. And in Italy, especially Southern Italy, where my family is from, there is a very different sort of cultural prioritization of values. You know, for my grandparents and my cousins and my uncles, you know, faith is probably the most important thing in their life. And then maybe family is second, and maybe work is third. And I think by being able to spend time in a different culture that has a different sort of priorities, both in a micro level in the course of our weeks, being able to spend time in communities that couldn't care less what you do for work, and on a more macro level, being able to spend time in potentially a place that has a different value system than the community that you're normally part of. I think this is one of the things that Joe was able to get exposed to in that month. It's a very different way of determining your worth when you aren't at the office every day, when you're surrounded by activities or projects or people that conceive of you as more than just a worker. There really is a shift in perspective that can enliven a different part of who you are. And so, you know, certainly I don't think a sabbatical is something that everyone has the same access to. If people could go off and spend a month living in Barcelona or in Southeast Asia or in Italy or what have you, I definitely encourage it. But I think people often have such a white knuckle grip on their career and think that if they aren't somehow getting ahead, they're going to start falling behind, that they lose out on some of these opportunities to get the perspective that actually might help them better align their time with what they value themselves.
Yeah, it was really interesting that, you know, people in my team, there are a couple of people who are new to the team this year, it's their first August off, and they were sort of saying it took them a bit of time to be like, I don't have to do anything, like to sort of wind themselves down from what should I achieve with this gift I've been given? What's the thing that I should perform doing in August, and actually being able to actually like, no, I've just, there's all these things I can do with my life. And it was really interesting, the thing on Barcelona. I've got a good friend who lives in Barcelona, and she said to me when we first took it off, and she got my out of office, which was very much like, oh, you know, we're taking August off and this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, and here's an article that I wrote, and da, 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 da. And then she was like, yeah, I got this. And then all my Spanish friends that I've emailed is just like, I'll be back at the end of August. You know, it's just, there's no big
explanation necessary.
It's just like, no, that's what we're doing. Of course, it's August, you know, and it's so common in lots of places in Europe. And I think that, you know, that thing for me, it caused such a big fuss the first year we did it. And all these people, just so much attention. And me being like, oh, it really sort of shocked me. I was thinking, this is a really good thing to do. And then suddenly I was like, oh, is it? It just felt really normal to me. It feels like such an obvious idea because so many people do it because it is needed. Not least because you've got to look after your kids because they're not at school. And actually most of my team don't have kids, but yeah, that's something I'm learning. I definitely won't be putting my feet up in August.
Somebody else has asked here, I'm wondering how workism may be reflected by different racial groups in America.
Yeah, it's a great question. I didn't look too much at race as a particular way across the data. I think income bracket is a much more relevant determinant when it comes to some of these questions about work time. Certainly, you know, work is problematic at different ends of the income spectrum for different reasons. The majority of low earners work so much because they have to, not because they choose to. And with stagnant wages, people are working more hours just to afford the same loaf of bread. And so I'm glad you asked the question. I think there are different ways to frame the question of why is our relationship to work so fraught in America. And certainly for many people, they would say, I would love to have the problem of choosing to work so much. But I'm reminded of one cook that I interviewed in the book who said, you know, people who love what they do, those people are blessed. I just work to get by. And it is a question that, you know, on places like Cambridge Forum, we can afford to sit around and pontificate how many hours we should or want to be working. And yet the majority of people, it's not a choice. They're having to work long hours because that's what they have to do in order to put food on the table.
Yeah.
You've raised a very important point there, because it's not just the meaning of life discussion we're having here. It's the fact that workers, you know, like the people that work for the Amazon warehouses, which has a very high incidence of accident ratio because of the hours people put in, people that do deliveries, the very intense long hours that people have to work. Part of this is the erosion of workers' rights and the lack of organized union representation in this country, which makes this even more of a significant discussion. It's not just the luxury of, should I do this, should I do that? Is there meaning? It's, is this healthy for me to work, overwork this much? I mean, the fact that we talked about the statistic with Germany, how is it that we've gone so off kilter and we're now working 30% more than the average German? This is not something casual. This is something very dangerous, because you've got people with health concerns as a result. You've got people with mental conditions as a result of this kind of stress. So I think this is an important discussion beside the, you know, the esoteric implications of, is it right? Is it wrong? Is it what I want in my life? It's, are we expecting too much of people?
Mm.
Yeah, something I've been thinking about recently is with the United Auto Workers Union strike right now. These are the same people who were able to fight for a lot of our modern standards for the work, modern workday and the modern work week, the 8-hour day, the 5-day week. These were things that were hard-fought wins from organized labor. And I think it's important to recognize that they were negotiated before and they can be negotiated again. And the same sort of standards of the folks who were able to get us to an 8-hour workday and a 5-day work week might be the same folks that make a 4-day work week a new precedent for the world. You know, I think there, it's easy to think about our current standards of working as being things that were delivered from up on high, and this is just the way that things have always been. And that's not true. And I do think, you know, if you think about cross-culturally to Germany, the erosion of organized labor in the United States is a huge role to play in the ways that workers have continued to get exploited, not just in the hours that they work, but the lack of protection, the lack of job security, the precarity that so many workers across the economy face.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, we faced a lot of, you know, people saying to us, oh, but, you know, not everyone can do what you're doing. And I think, well, yeah, no, they can't at the moment. And I think that there are so, you know, when we look at the paradigm we're in, we thought, well, we couldn't do that with the NHS in the UK, because how would people, you know, and I think it's, but I think normally that is coming from, well, we've existed like this for what we think as a really long time, so it couldn't possibly be different. But as you were saying, you know, it changed once, it can change again, or you know, and that the pandemic did show, you know, no one would have ever said before the pandemic, oh, everyone could suddenly work from home. It's a no, it's impossible, it could never happen. And then when it had to happen, it did. And yet somehow we've kind of collectively tried to forget about this massive change we were able to make, and really trying to cling on to other ways of being that could also easily change.
Good point. Before you tell us about any advice you could throw away, Miguel has said another point, which is in Scandinavian countries like Sweden, working too hard at the company is seen badly by society. They call it lagom, L-A-J-O-M, not too much, not too little. Balance. All right. So do you have any words of wisdom for us before we recommend that you consider buying the book maybe and just looking at other people doing things differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think one part of this discussion that we just started to get into that's important to consider is that I think when we think about work-life balance, often people put the onus on the individual. We say things like, you know, practice self-care or, you know, set a boundary. But in actuality, I think the institutions, both the employers and the government, are actually in the position to enact some of the structural protections that will make work better for workers. And so that's why I'm so encouraged by leaders like Joe that are able to model the type of cultures that they hope to create. You know, your company can bring in a motivational work-life balance speaker or have policies that talk about how much they respect people's lives outside of the office. But if the boss is sending emails at 10 p.m., that's going to trickle down to the rest of the company. And so I really am inspired by leaders who are able to practice what they preach. And then I think the governments in our lives are able to enact some of the structural protections that really protect workers from going off the rails. I think it's important to consider the difference between boundaries, the sort of dotted lines in the middle of the street versus guardrails, the types of things that keep people from driving off the road. And if we want to have a better relationship to work in our life, I think we have to separate our basic human needs from our employment status. We have to see our survival as something that is more important than something that just people with W-2 full-time employment deserve.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think, you know, for me, it is that, you know, we talk about mental health and burnout as if they're individual problems. And what really irks me is when, you know, employers are putting in things like mindfulness sessions or, you know, maybe even therapy or really what feel like really good interventions for their staff, but actually not addressing the fact that the reason that their staff are feeling like that is because of some really basic provisions in the workplace. And I think it is about, you know, that move away from making it the individual's problem is huge for, like you said, both for government and for companies individually, and for people to understand that, for individuals to understand that, because I think we all feel under an immense amount of pressure when we think, oh, everything, all my mental health is my responsibility. And of course we have to take responsibility for ourselves and our mental well-being, but also acknowledge the incredible amount of, you know, stuff that's happening in the world, not just through our work, but around us, and the stress that is, you know, is ever present from living in the world that we live in right now. So on that note, also take some time out to do a bit of creativity is my number one words of wisdom. You can join the January challenge for free at 64millionartists.com.
Is that a real thing?
The January challenge? Yeah, 50,000 people take part each year. We take people from all over the world. So we've just signed up some really amazing people to set challenges this year, and from communities to kind of big artists who they set a little creative challenge for you to do. It's free to do, 5 minutes each day. This gives you a little lift, but also you share with the community online and kind of get to know all sorts of people through making.
So we just need to do that email address for that website address again for people.
64millionartists.com is the name, is the website.
Okay, we've just had some lovely glowing compliments from people saying how insightful and helpful this was.
Oh, great.
And about structuring your life and your schedule, and can't wait to read the book. So on that note, I'm going to say thanks to Seema Stolzoff, author of the book, The Good Enough Job, in which he examines how work has come to dominate our lives, and why we find it difficult to separate identity and self-worth from our jobs. And Joe Hunter, CEO and co-founder of 64 Million Artists, discussing the nature of our relationship with work and how it shapes our identity. And thanks to everyone who joined us online. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course, all of you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.